projection to do it.
What does literature sound like? What stories will we hear if we listen to the archive? Welcome to the Spoken Web Podcast, stories about how literature sounds. My name is Hannah McGregor, and each month I'll be bringing you different stories of Canadian literary history and our contemporary responses to it, created by scholars, poets, students, and artists from across Canada. As we dive into episode 2 in the Spoken Web series, I want you to picture the oldest recording technology you can think of. What are you picturing? Is it a cassette player? You can tell me if it's a cassette player. Is it a phonograph? Maybe a wax cylinder? In this episode, Spoken Web researcher Jason Camlott interviews collaborators in the Spoken Web Network to uncover the stories behind the making of early literature recordings. Drawn from his recent book, Phonopoetics, Jason invites guests Lisa Gittleman, Patrick Feaster, David Subert, John Miller, and Matthew Rubery to question the cultural, technological, and personal meaning of early sound recordings. Together, they consider how and why we're interested in these early recordings and what motivates scholars to research them and collectors to collect them. What did these recordings mean when they first appeared in the world? And what do they mean now? Here is Jason Camlott with episode 2, Sound Recordings Are Weird, Stories and Thoughts About Early Spoken Recordings.
Part 1. Old sound recordings are weird. No, there's nothing wrong with your device. Do not adjust your radio dial, so to speak. What you are listening to is an early sound recording. I'm Jason Camlott, a professor of English at Concordia University in Montreal, a Victorianist scholar, that's someone who studies 19th century literature and culture, and a researcher who is interested in the relationships that exist between sound and literature. If you listened to the first episode of the Spoken Web podcast, you might recall that the sound you have just heard is what first got me interested in research about the history of sound recording and how people have read literature out loud since the 19th century. I was an undergraduate student taking a full year of Victorian literature class. We were studying the poetry of Lord Alfred Tennyson. And then one morning, my professor, John Miller...
I'm John Miller, and I've retired from teaching Victorian literature at Concordia University in Montreal.
Walked in with a boombox.
The classrooms weren't equipped, so I had to get a boombox trundle into the class and fiddle with the dials and so on.
And played us that recording you just heard. I have to say, the first time I heard the piece, I found it to be a bit off-putting and scary, because of the way it sounded, but also kind of strange and wonderful, sort of magical.
I think there was some fairly stunned silence, because, of course, none of us ever expected anything like this.
It was exciting to know that this long-dead poet we were studying was all of a sudden transported to us in our classroom through a boombox. Many years later, I asked John Miller if he remembered the first time that he had heard the recording.
I first heard the recording when I was a graduate student. in a full-year Tennyson and Browning course, and John Pettigrew, who was teaching the course, had a copy of it and wowed us one day.
I asked him if he remembers what it sounded like to him when he first heard it.
Incomprehensible.
After a while, as you listen to an old recording repeatedly, you can get past the strangeness of the sound and begin to decipher the words and tune into the way the reader is delivering or performing the poem. You come to hear the reading as a form of interpretation, a manner of actually performing the meaning of the poem through the use of different kinds of intonation and other vocal techniques that shape the sound of the text with and through the reader's voice. There were lots of different interpretations of this same poem recorded by Victorian actors and elocutionists around the turn of the 19th century.
Heartily, 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 onward. All in the valley of death, roll the 600.
Forward, the light brigade.
Charge
for the guns in death. Into the valley of death.
The recording we have of Tennyson reading his own poem is the first such recorded oral interpretation of his poem. It gets us thinking about how Tennyson interpreted his own poetry with his voice.
It's, I think the term that we came up with was elegiac rather than heroic. Tennyson recites the poem so slowly that any heroism is evaporated. And really, I think his performance reverses much of the conventional wisdom of the about the poem at the time.
Forward, the Light Brigade! Charge for the guns, he said, into the valley of death.
The heroic sound of the poem that John Miller refers to is clearly audible in this torrential rendition of the poem by Victorian stage actor Lewis Waller, known for what James Naramore has described as his phallic performing skill. The interpretation that John Miller hears in Tennyson's reading goes against that standard accepted idea about the meaning of the charge.
That it was a kind of newspaper poet laureate glorification of British foolhardy gallantry rather than a lament for the disaster that it was.
Half a league, half a league, half a league onward. All in the valley of death rode the 600. Forward, the Light Brigade. Charge for the guns, he said. Into the valley of death rode the 600. Ellipsis, dot, dot, dot. When can their glory fade? Oh, the wild charge they made, all the world wondered. Honor the charge they made. Honor the Light Brigade, noble 600. This translation of an unintelligible old recording into clear, or at least clearer, words that I have just performed represents an act of demystification, an unweirding of this old recording. Old sound recordings, like the one we just heard, are weird. Not just because we can't always decipher what the actual sounds are, but because, well, firstly, the recording has preserved the voice of a famous person from another century, whose voice we may have thought was lost for all time. So, it's weird to have an emanation from that body, assumed eternally absent, resonate again, vibrate through the air for us to hear. It creates a kind of vocalic body, evoking the physical body that's no longer there. That idea of the vocalic body comes from Stephen Connor's book about ventriloquism. Secondly, the recording itself doesn't sound normal to us. This is because we are listening to a digitized version of a different material medium, a late Victorian brown wax cylinder. The particular cylinder behind this recording wasn't preserved according to best archival practices. It lost some of its shape over time, distorting the voice of the poet, making it kind of warped or eerie or creepy sounding to our modern ears, and adding other sounds that are derived from the material medium itself, from the wax. Those sounds become even stranger as the sound is migrated from one media format to another. In the case of this early Tennyson wax cylinder recording, it went from brown wax cylinder to a small flat disc record that was sold to the public by the Tennyson Society. John Miller purchased that record and then transferred that to a cassette tape and played it through a boombox. Hearing odd cylinder noises through a 1980s boombox estranges the original sound from its source. Same goes for when we turn it into an MP3 file and listen to it through a computer or iPhone. There are a lot of additional sounds beyond the voice that we cannot identify in this recording. For example, starting from about 1 minute and 33 seconds into the recording, we hear a loud banging sound. We can't know if this is a feature of the recording technology, or if Tennyson himself was simply getting carried away with his recitation, banging a lectern or a table as he performed the poem. This is what John Miller assumed the banging sound to be.
I think there are points at which he is pounding his cane on the floor, points at which he runs out of breath. And that does give an extraordinary sense of the life, I think.
An extraordinary sense of Tennyson's sonic presence, of his vocalic body. There's also the issue of context. We can't always hear context in a sound recording, although there are sometimes clues that can be heard. In this case, it's hard for us to understand what was going on at the time. Why was he even making this recording? What would that have been like for him? Where was he exactly? What time was it? Was he reading or reciting his poem by heart? These old sound recordings are like escaped fugitives from their original media and historical contexts. And yet, despite all this strangeness, even with all this missing information, when we hear a historical voice recording, when we listen to Tennyson read The Charge of the Light Brigade again, over 100 years after he recited it into a phonograph, there's something very real about it. This sense of the realness of recorded sound seems to have been felt by listeners even at the earliest exhibitions of the tinfoil phonograph.
I think there is something to that this was an experience of kind of temporal continuity, right? That there was a slice of time that was being inscribed onto these sheets of tinfoil in a way that when you write down what somebody said, you're putting down the words, but you're not putting down a slice of time. My name is Lisa Gittleman. I'm a professor at New York University, where I teach in the departments of English and the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication. There were several ways, I guess we could say, that these recordings and these exhibitions became experiences of temporality, right? The kind of preservative nature of the tinfoil, but also the kind of the temporal duration of the recording itself.
The real-time quality of recorded sound, that it puts us into time that has already passed and opens a tunnel connection with the past, triggers what philosopher Wolfgang Ernst has called the drama of time-critical media. I like the idea that something dramatic happens when we play with time by playing sound recordings. An encounter with a recorded sound develops as an experience of real-time processing. It gives the listener the sense that the temporal process one is hearing is living in the present, replicating the live event of which it is apparently a real-time reproduction. Sound recording works on human perception itself, and on our perception of time in particular. So, Ernst's argument about the strange drama of sound recording is based on his idea that we're not cognitively equipped to process events from two temporal dimensions at the same time. When we immerse ourselves in real-time sound, we perceive it as live, and this jars our awareness of time. So, that's another weird quality of early sound recordings. They give us the experience of feeling time as multidimensional. In that way, a phonograph is like a time machine, and we're the time travelers. As an aside, H.G. Wells published his story, The Time Machine, in 1895, soon after the invention of sound recording and film media technologies. Maybe he was inspired by this weird drama of time-critical media that Wolfgang Ernst is talking about. Part 2. What is an early sound recording? How did recording sounds become possible? And how did those early technologies work? Maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves. As we just heard from Lisa Gittleman, wax cylinders weren't even the first recording technology, just my personal entry into the world of recorded sound. Like a lot of innovations, in hindsight, it seems almost obvious that humans would record sound, including the human voice, and play this back for all the reasons we've come to expect. However, like a lot of human inventions, there was a certain degree of serendipity involved in the development of recording technologies. And also, some inventive talent. It shouldn't be much of a surprise that one name kept coming up.
Thomas Edison.
Thomas Edison.
Edison.
Thomas Edison.
I have a doctorate in literature, so I'm a person who's interested in texts, interested in reading and writing. And after I went to graduate school, I got a job at Rutgers University in New Jersey, working with a team of scholars that have for a long time been researching and publishing the papers of the American inventor Thomas Edison.
That's Lisa Gittleman again.
And I spent many years working with that team of scholars to, sort of educate ourselves and educate the public about this archive and what was in it. And one of the things in it was a lot of material about the invention of recorded sound. And I just was kind of bitten by the bug and became fascinated, in particular with the kind of earliest moments in 1877 and 1878, when the idea of recorded sound itself didn't really exist. Of the most precious things there were experimental notebooks. So we have the original experimental notebooks in which Edison and his team of inventors were playing around in the 1870s, let's say in the fall of 1877 or the summer of 1877, with lots of telephone devices, basically trying to invent a better telephone. And there was a lot of work in this period by Edison and by many others on telephone and telegraph work. And there were lots of telegraph systems that did involve paper tapes, right? Either telegraphic messages printed on paper tape or paper tape used as a kind of repeating device for telegraph communication to make telegraphy a little bit more automatic. So using paper was something they had around, and it also locked into expectations about inscription. And we have documents that more or less show us a certain moment when Edison realized, look, the way we're doing this, we could actually use this technology to not just, sort of transmit sound, but actually save it up. So you can actually see this in the manuscript notebooks. And then, of course, there are lots and lots of pieces of correspondence, then business papers, then some promotional materials. So the archive is just a kind of many splendored collection of oddities in a way, but it's filled with these stories that can be pieced back together by historians who go through the papers.
I'm going to try to take you through a history of acoustic recording technologies, from the pre-recording phonautograph of the 1860s to the invention of the tinfoil phonograph in 1877, to the perfected wax cylinder phonograph in 1888, and then eventually to the introduction of flat disc gramophone records and beyond. To give this early historical account of sound recording technologies, I'd like to introduce you to...
My name's Patrick Feaster. I'm Media Preservation Specialist for the Media Digitization and Preservation Initiative at Indiana University, and I study the cultural, social, and technological history of sound recording with a particular emphasis on very, very early sound recordings. When we talk about sound recordings today, we generally think of them as something that is intended mainly to be listened to. You record speech, music,
testing, 1, 2, 3, testing.
Some kind of sound, then you play it back again as sound.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, testing.
The first person to record a sound out of the air and then play it back was Thomas Edison in 1877, but he was not the first person to record a sound out of the air. The first person to record a sound out of the air was Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville. He was a scientific proofreader who, in about 1852, 1853, was given a treatise on physiology, which included a section describing how the human ear and eardrum work. As he read this, he began imagining to himself an artificial eardrum that would vibrate in the same way that a human eardrum does, but then instead of passing those vibrations along to the auditory nerve and the brain so that we could hear them, it would write them down so that, as he imagined, any sound that the human ear was capable of hearing could be written down in this way. The invention he came up with consisted, first of all, of a big funnel with a membrane at one end of it. And the idea was you'd direct sounds of speech, song, whatever it was, into this funnel. They would cause the membrane to vibrate. Then a stylus attached to the other side of the membrane would move back and forth with the vibrations. Now, underneath the stylus would be a sheet of paper covered with the soot of an oil lamp and wrapped around a cylinder. And as sounds were directed into the funnel, you'd rotate the cylinder. And as the stylus moved back and forth, it would draw a wavy line in the soot. After you'd made your recording, you'd take the sheet of paper off the drum. You'd fix it in an alcohol bath, kind of like fixing a charcoal drawing. And then you'd have this visual record of sound. Now, the wavy line on that sheet of paper contains the same kind of information as the wavy groove on an LP. In both cases, we're dealing with a graph of sound vibrations, the amplitude of sound vibrations over time. But Scott's phonautograms were not intended for playback, which hadn't yet occurred to anybody as a possibility at this point. Instead, he thought of the phonautograph as recording sounds in the same sense that a seismograph records earthquakes. You would not expect to be able to take a seismograph record of an earthquake and use it to create another earthquake. In fact, if you could do that, seismographs would probably be a lot more tightly controlled. But at the same time, we don't think of seismographs as not really recording earthquakes. They really do. They graph out the vibrations of the earth tremors and so forth. And similarly, these records were records of sound, but they were intended to be looked at visually, not listened to. Scott wasn't sure exactly what people would be able to make of these records. He had rather ambitious thoughts that people would learn to decipher recorded words from them. You could perhaps sit and look at a recording of a performance of dramatic oratory or an operatic aria sitting in your chair at home. And maybe if you learned to read these things well enough, you could imagine in your mind's ear what the performance had sounded like. But again, it was to be strictly a visual record. That's not to say that we can't play them back today. In fact, we can. What we need to do is make a high-resolution scan of the phonautogram, use an algorithm to detect the position of the wavy line, and then convert that information into samples in a digital sound file. Once we do that, we can listen to the recordings Scott made, even though at the time they were made, there was no mechanism available to turn them back into sound. There are a few more things we need to do to get intelligible sound out of a phonautogram. The cylinder on which sounds were recorded was turned by hand, so the recording speed was very irregular. If we were to play the sound waves straight off the paper as they appear, there would be extreme speed fluctuations, so severe that you wouldn't be able to recognize the melody of a tune, something like that. Fortunately, Scott recorded the vibrations of a tuning fork next to the trace of the voice. And the nice thing about that is that the tuning fork always has the same number of vibrations in a given amount of time. And so if we adjust the tuning fork so that it's at a constant frequency, then we bring the voice in along with it. We can correct for the speed fluctuations from the hand cranking of the cylinder. When we do this, we can hear songs, recitations, very much as they sounded back in the day. The timbre was not recorded so successfully, but the pitch very much was. Scott's recordings were all test recordings to one degree or another. He was really still trying to figure out whether his invention worked and what it could be used to do. So he didn't go out and record the voices of famous people or famous singers. He pretty much just recorded himself, his own voice. But there was some variety in his recordings. Sometimes he is clearly conducting a dry scientific experiment. Maybe he's pronouncing words very slowly and deliberately, or singing a song like Au Clair de la Lune, but holding each note for an uncomfortably long amount of time. The idea here was to see whether, looking at the trace afterwards, you could understand what was going on. You could tell one note from another. Maybe different vowel sounds, different consonants would look different from one another. In these cases, that's the sort of thing he was trying to figure out. But sometimes he lets loose with something that really is a full-fledged performance, a piece of impassioned dramatic oratory, a lively rendition of a song from the opera. Here Scott is experimenting with another of his goals for the phonautograph, which is that it could record virtuosic performances. That is, you could have the celebrated figures of the theater and the music hall stand in front of the phonautograph, perform the works for which they were best known. Once they were recorded as phonautograms, perhaps the genius of these people wouldn't die with them, but future generations could experience it. They could look at those phonautograms. They could hear the performances again in their mind's ear.
Well, the real breakthrough, I think, was when they released themselves, in a sense, from the idea that paper was a recording medium and started to try experiments with sheets of tinfoil. So the first successful recording surface was sheets of tinfoil, which sounds weird. They are paper-like, right? They certainly are come in sheets, but it was a slightly more durable material, and it sort of proved useful for what they were trying to do, which is a very kind of crude acoustic recording. The original device was not electronic in any way. It was just mechanical. And in a sense, the tinfoil was part of the machine. So in 1877, and then more so in 1878, the tinfoil phonograph started to gain a lot of popular attention in newspapers. And eventually there are kind of worldwide demonstrations of this then miraculous device.
So what this machine looked like, I mean, it was basically a long cylinder with a handle or a crank at the end that you could sort of spin to make the machine revolve. And had a funnel attached to it that the speaker would speak into. And then the sound of their voice, the vibrations in the air, would create indentations on the tinfoil. And then those indentations on the sheet of tinfoil that was wrapped around the cylinder, that was sort of the first sound recording. My name is Matthew Ruberry. I am professor of modern literature at Queen Mary, University of London. Theoretically, that sheet of tinfoil could be replayed again and again, and taken off the machine and put back on another machine and played again. But in reality, it did not go so smoothly. Often these sheets of tinfoil tore. They were quite delicate. It was very difficult to rewrap a sheet of tinfoil around a cylinder again once you'd taken it off. And then you had to sort of get the rotation speed just right. So you had to have a real skilled operator to turn that handle at just the right speed to recapture the pitch of the original voice. But these tinfoil phonographs were the first ones that were made, and sort of scraps of tinfoil that were given out at the end of these exhibitions. I mean, what a souvenir. Those would be incredibly valuable today.
Well, I mean, if I were to, imitate this recording for a classroom, I mean, it would be easy for me to, I mean, these sounded just terrible. You know, I'm going to, fake it, but I think they would have sounded like this. You know, just lots of scrapey surface noise. So the real question there is not so much, what are we listening to? But the real question becomes, how were people so excited about this new recording technology? That question takes you back again to this threshold when things are really new and you need a way to think about them. Apparently available in 1878 was an intuitive sense of fidelity. That, oh my God, that's you, on the recording, because there was nothing to compare it to.
My name is David Soibert, and I'm the curator of the Performing Arts Collection at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And part of my responsibilities here are the management of the Historical Sound Recordings Collection, which notably includes one of the world's largest collections of early cylinder recordings, about 19,000 titles at this point. And we also have the Discography of American Historical Recordings, which is a large database project to document the output of the early North American sound recording industry. A wax cylinder is really the commercial product that resulted from Thomas Edison's invention of sound recording in the 1870s, where he initially recorded onto a roll of tinfoil wrapped around a cylindrical mandrel in order to use it for mass production of audio content, whether that's spoken or music or whatever else it might be. They developed a wax cylinder, which is a hard metallic soap that allowed for people to both record onto it and then to play it back as well. So unlike flat discs, wax cylinders are really a read-write medium like cassette tapes or like an MP3 file where individuals could buy commercially produced recordings or make their own. So we have some early interesting content there on cylinders.
The history of early sound recording technologies reveals a close connection between sound and visual text or script. As Patrick Feaster explained, the original idea for sound recording, the phonautograph, didn't even imagine playing it back, but conceived of sound recording as a kind of sound-to-printed script technology. The sound goes in and produces a squiggly line that we might perhaps be able to read. Léon Scott wasn't able to read the squiggles with his own eyes, but Patrick and his colleagues who work on the First Sounds project were able to get a computer to read them as digital data, and to make that play the sounds that were originally recorded in the 1860s. Pretty amazing. Amazing, in part, because acoustic recording technologies are so very basic. A simple mechanical approach to capturing the air pressure produced by sound-producing events, like a person speaking. There's no electrical transduction of the air pressure in this acoustic process. Just a horn or tube to direct the sounds toward a thin diaphragm that is sensitive to the changes in air pressure, and a stylus or needle that records those changes in air pressure onto something, paper, tinfoil, wax, for safekeeping. and then a reversal of just the same process, in this case from recorded bumps or squiggles on a material surface via a stylus, to make the diaphragm shiver and stir the air again, and a horn to make us hear those air pressure movements as the sound that had stirred the air in the past. The connection between sound recording and writing was strong from the beginning. But thinking of sound as a kind of printed text may distort or limit our understanding, our apprehension, our hearing of what a spoken recording really is. What if we try to think of these recordings not as visual scripts to be played, not as spoken or sounded versions of print works, but as audio texts, as generic forms in sound? Part 3. What are the formal and generic features of early sound recordings? What does it mean to think of a recorded speech as a formal entity? What are the elements that constitute the shape and significance of the audio text? The sound of early speech recordings can help us think about how to answer these kinds of questions. They help us hear how the nature of the recording technology itself had an impact on the sonic qualities of the audio text that could be produced. As we now know, the technological and material underpinnings of an audio text have a hand in shaping how it was produced, used, and consequently, the social and cultural meanings it might come to have. This is a pretty typical argument of design theory, which suggests that the material substratum of an artifact informs the possible courses of action that can be taken with it and frames the practices and meanings that surround it. Now, I don't mean to say that the capacities and limits of the phonograph as a recording and sound playing device, or the material affordances of a wax cylinder as a storage media format, completely determined the use and meaning of all of the sounds that were recorded and preserved with phonograph cylinder technology. But they did play a role in deciding what kinds of sounds could be captured, and in the case of speech recordings, what kinds of spoken audio texts could be produced. Two quick examples of this. 1. Acoustic sound recording required the speaker to speak loudly. You practically had to shout to make that diaphragm vibrate enough so the stylus would dig into the wax deeply enough for the recording to be audible when it was played back. This affordance of phonograph recording technology meant that you couldn't be all that subtle in your recitation of a literary work. You couldn't whisper a poem into a phonograph. It wouldn't stick. So early speech recordings couldn't rely on wide ranges in amplitude, that's volume or loudness, to communicate the feelings of the speaker. Here's a second example. Cylinders could hold no more than a few minutes of sound. So the storage capacity of the wax cylinder as a preservation medium had some serious implications for what kinds of texts and speeches could be recorded.
You know, the format was short. I mean, a cylinder up until 1908 or so only held 2 minutes of content. And after 1908, they introduced 4-minute cylinders.
That's David Soibert again.
So Edison, when he invented his phonograph, the first sort of prototype made in December of 1877.
Dr. Matthew Rubery.
Yeah, so going all the way back to the 19th century here, he tested it out by reading or reciting Mary Had a Little Lamb. And I think that's an interesting choice. And there's been a lot of speculation about, you know, why start recorded sound history with this particular example. And a few reasons come to mind. I mean, one is it's a very short verse, and the first recordings could only record, you know, I think this one was under 10 seconds, which was perfect for a test case. It's also something that sort of sticks in the mind quite easily, so you don't have to think about the words. They just sort of come effortlessly to you, as many nursery rhymes still do. It's also helpful for an audience when listening to these early recordings, because even though at the time the recording quality was talked about as being incredibly lifelike, I mean, when you hear these today, they sound practically inaudible.
Oh, we have a living lamb. It seems so slow. that is snow. And everywhere that snow is, the earth is still to grow.
So it helped to have a recording that was familiar. The Lord's Prayer, for instance, was another recording that was often used to sort of demonstrate the phonograph technology of the time.
The Holy Ghost, amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be
thy. But that way, so when people heard these verses read aloud, they could recognize them clearly. Whereas if they heard something unfamiliar, it'd be a lot more difficult for them to actually hear what was being said. So some of the earliest recordings then, I mean, started out with just snippets of nursery rhymes, a verse or two of poetry, maybe a short speech from a play. And these were all sort of fit the earliest sound recording devices, which could only record up to 2 or 3 minutes. But they worked great, too, for public demonstrations where the phonograph technology would be taken around to places and debuted in different cities. And let's say a scrap of verse might be read, a speech might be recorded as well, some funny noises by the exhibitor might be made, a little bit of music, too, to give the sense of the variety of things that could be done with these phonographs. That was what happened, you know, in 1878 when the phonograph first came out. And it wasn't until about 10 years later then that we get to some of the more literary recordings or serious exhibitions. So the phonograph sort of disappears for 10 years after that.
You weren't going to make a recording of Paradise Lost or a full-length play or novel, because it would have required many hundreds of wax cylinders to do so. Early on, when he first introduced the phonograph, Edison had bragged in some newspaper articles about soon having Charles Dickens' novel Nicholas Nickleby on a single audio record.
The main thing holding back audiobooks or full-length audiobooks is what we talked about earlier, the fact that records could only hold 2 or 3 minutes of sound up until the 1930s. And it's not until 1934 that the technology is capable of recording an entire full-length book on a set of discs, let's say 9 or 10 records for an average novel. So that's a big change from a few decades earlier when Mark Twain once tried to record one of his novels using these wax cylinders that could only hold a few minutes of speech. And he got up to, I think, about 40 or so and then just gave up because it just wasn't going to work. There were way too many cylinders needed to make a literary recording. But in the 1930s, the radio industry and organizations representing blind people start collaborating to come up with a way to make the record record as much as 20 minutes of speech on each side of a disc. And once that breakthrough is made, that enables the first full-length recorded books to be made. And interestingly enough, they're not made for sighted people. The first recorded books are made for blind people beginning in 1934.
Typhoon by Joseph Conrad, written in 1903. Recorded for the Talking Book Library for the Blind, by kind permission of the trustees for the estate of the late Joseph Conrad. Chapter 1.
So it's a rare example of people with disabilities receiving a technology in advance of everyone else. And it's not till about 10 years later, until 1948, that those LP records, long playing records, go on the commercial market.
So the forms of early spoken recordings were necessarily short, and the audio texts produced were either abridged versions of longer works or ingeniously condensed synecdochal instances or scenes that evoked a larger work from which they came. What actual genres of spoken recording did these media constraints make possible? You couldn't hear a whole Dickens novel on a cylinder, but you might hear a minor character addressing you as if you were a character yourself in such a novel, giving you the feeling that you were listening to a Dickens character as if he were a real person, and as if you were a fictional character.
Ah, my dear Copperbeam, come in, come in. I am rejoiced to see you at this transitory moment. Ah, and my dear legal friend Freda. Ah, welcome to this humble...
Or you might get a key transformation scene taken from the play adaptation of a novel to stand in for the novel as a whole, as if somehow Robert Louis Stevenson's The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde could be boiled down to the moment when the professional and respectable Jekyll, or Jekyll as the recording puts it, loses control and transforms into the atavistic monster, Hyde.
That terrible night when transformed as I was into that fiend incarnate, I murdered the father of the woman I loved. I must pray. Pray God to keep away the demon. The fiend is coming. Yes. Hide it here.
Stop that damned organ. The noise offends me ears. They come for me. They're going to take me to the gallows. But I don't die on the gallows.
Or George du Maurier's best-selling late Victorian novel Trilby could be summed up by the scene in which the treacherous and anti-Semitically rendered musical genius and mesmerist Svengali mesmerizes the innocent Trilby.
The day will come when I shall be the famous Svengali, and hundreds of beautiful women shall fall in love with me, princessin and contessin and serene English altessin. But Svengali will not look at them. He will look inward at his own dream, and that dream shall be all about trinity, to lay his heart, his genius, his 1,000 francs, at her beautiful white feet. And you shall see nothing, hear nothing, think nothing, but Svengali, Svengali.
While no sound recording offers a transparent or unmediated record of a performance event, early sound recordings demanded greater accommodation of the affordances of the recording technology and preservation media than those made after the widespread use of tape recording. So we can't separate a discussion of the kinds of recordings made in the first decades of sound recording from the technologies and media formats that were used to make them. That said, there were a great variety of genres of recordings made during the acoustic era of sound recording. Looking back to the beginning and the kinds of recordings that were made can help us try to understand why people were interested in these recordings, why they bought them when they became commercially available, and what they may have meant to the people who listened to them.
When a recorded sound first came into existence, the way people had to understand it was on its merits, in a sense, in relation to older technology, right? When a new technology comes along, the only way you can grapple with it is to look backward. And looking backward from recorded sound in the 1870s was really to think about text, was really to think about reading and writing, and what we now think of as all the alternatives to recorded sound.
That's Lisa Gittleman again.
Well, a bunch of people signed up with this company, this exhibition company. A lot of them were journalists, again, going back to the idea that this was somehow about writing and reading. But they were entertainers, too. In my research, I just became kind of fascinated with newspaper accounts of these demonstrations. And they all, I mean, weirdly, they all seemed to take something of a similar form. When people were faced with this recording device in small audiences or even large concert halls, they tended to mimic to the machine, to recite nursery rhymes, little scraps of Shakespeare, little tidbits of things they already had memorized, lots of kind of mimicry and animal noises and, you know, I won't say farting into the machine, but sort of that kind of mentality. There was a kind of, you know, lowbrow bonding, if you will, over the potential of this machine.
Histories of the commercial recording industry tend to focus on music, but really, the spoken word was a very important part of what it had to offer from the very beginning.
That's Patrick Feaster again.
Moreover, there were a few different types of recordings that featured spoken language very, very prominently. Some recordings were relatively straightforward recitations of existing, often well-known literary works. Somewhat more common than this were recordings in which a performer would take on some particular persona, often an ethnic character, and perform a monologue in that character, usually humorous. A number of different ethnicities were represented. Performer Will N. Steele specialized in a Jewish character named Einstein.
Babinski, my boy, Aki is a bright boy. Someday he shall set the world on fire and he'll get all the insurance.
Frank Kennedy had a German character named Schultz.
Children are a necessary evil. There's many different kinds of children. For instance, there's the good boy who goes to Sunday school. When he grows up, he becomes cashier in a bank. And if finally skips to Canada with all the money he can get a hold of.
But the best known example of this type was a performer named Cal Stewart, whose character Uncle Josh Weathersby was enormously popular for about 20 years.
Well, sir, we've just had our annual camp meeting at Pumpkin Center, and...
This was a character from rural New England who would tell about his naive blunders visiting New York City, or sometimes he'd talk about things that happened back home in Pumpkin Center.
It was a great affair. Well, for several days, we was pretty busy baking and cooking and making preparations.
And then there's a third category of more elaborate productions in much the same spirit as later radio drama or radio comedy, where you have multiple characters performing, sound effects, music, all fitting together to convey some story through sound.
Morning, Deputy.
Morning, Sanjay.
Sanjay, say, Zeb, don't you know me? Wait till I take off my whiskers.
Well, I'll be darned if it ain't the constable. What be you doing outside?
Doing of? Detectiving, that's what I'm doing of.
What
the... But this was done with the phonograph much earlier. Examples of this dating back well into the 1890s. Not all early phonographic audio theater was humorous. There were serious examples, including a dramatization of the San Francisco earthquake, reenactments of battles in the Spanish-American War, one piece by Ada Jones and Len Spencer called House Cleaning Time.
Mary, let me in.
John Smith, don't you dare come in without drying your feet on the mat.
Why, woman, my feet are so wet you couldn't dry them on the stove.
Well, come in, ma'am.
Is really more of a sentimental piece, an old couple reminiscing about their lives together. But a majority of it is humorous. And a very large proportion of it involves ethnic humor.
Good morning, Mrs. Riley, and how are you this morning?
There were practical reasons for this, much the same as the practical reasons that made ethnic humor so popular in other venues, on the vaudeville stage, in high dialect pieces published as filler in newspapers. Invoking an ethnic stereotype meant you didn't have to spend any time on character development. By taking on an Irish stage dialect, a Black stage dialect, a German or so-called Dutch stage dialect, any one of a number of different conventionalized ways of speaking. But as soon as you adopt one of these conventionalized dialects, you can take for granted that your audience will make certain assumptions about the character you're representing and will understand what's going on based on them. And if all you have to work with is a short slot on a vaudeville schedule, a few lines of space in a newspaper, or 2 to 3 minutes of sound recording, then this type of efficiency can be very valuable.
Part 4. Why early spoken recordings are important for our understanding of the longer history of audiobooks, sound recording, and performance today. When I say that early sound recordings are weird, maybe what I'm really saying is that recordings from the early period of the technology can teach us a lot about those of subsequent periods. The fact that we are estranged from the content, media, and methods of performance in early sound recordings help us see and hear the elements that are less obvious to us in the case of recordings and media that we take for granted today. When we think about literary history by engaging with sound archives, it requires us to think about how the recordings that document the performance of literary texts, conversations, and activities were made and used, and how the media and methods of production shaped the audio documents we can hear today. When tape recording became widely accessible in the 1960s, with people carrying portable woolen sack and Ewer reel-to-reel tape recorders around, they still weighed like 20 pounds, so not quite so portable as an audio cassette Walkman, a mini disc recorder, or an iPhone. Still, when they were carrying these woolen sacks and Ewers around, Suddenly, live readings that lasted an hour or more could be captured and listened to in another time and place.
It's the sort of thing we do in Vancouver. Like, we sit down and read the whole book. And this was published the same day as Dan Persky's The Day, a book called The Day. And it's about the same length, about 100 pages. And he read The Day, and then we took a break, and I read Autobiology. And then we took a break of a couple hours, and then he read The Day again.
We know that literary readings lasting hours did take place in the 19th century, too. There are newspaper reports about that. But there were no reel-to-reel tape recorders back then. Our audible history of the literary past is shaped in part by the material nature of the media and archives we have today. Early recordings help us understand that about all subsequent media recordings, even the seemingly invisible digital formats like MP3 files. The difference between digital audio media and the analog and acoustic media technologies is pretty significant. For one thing, analog media capture sound in one continuous stream, and in that sense represent a kind of material index of the original sound event it records. Digital media, on the other hand, capture microcosmic slices, samples according to a bitrate, a frequency data that allows us to rehear the past events. They certainly sound as clear or clearer to us than all previous analog media, and they can record sound events for longer than any previous material medium. Just depends on how much hard drive storage space you have. But there are missing spaces in the documented temporal event in digital audio files that aren't there in analog recordings. Maybe that makes a difference. Born digital recordings, or digitized recordings of the past, turn literary sound into a new kind of data with its own remarkable affordances. We can control, analyze, and listen to such audible data in a greater variety of ways than we could with earlier audio media technologies. It's now very easy to record, store entire novels on portable devices and to replay them in a variety of places, in the kitchen, walking the dog, at the gym, driving to work, and to replay them in different ways. For example, at different speeds without changing the pitch of the reader's voice. Speed listening has been around since the 1930s, at least. Recent work by Matthew Rubery, Jonathan Stern, and Mara Mills has shown this. But digital media make possibilities for the manipulation of the human voice virtually infinite.
A set of drum rondos from synth loops in the Cyborg Opera.
We may admire an avant-garde poet's performance of synthetic sounds, like Christian Bach vocalizing drum loops in a movement from his Cyborg Opera, as evidence of ingenuity and virtuosity in performance. But really, with digital media plugins, what can't the human voice sound like or do? Since the end of the 19th century, each phase of media history, performance history, literary history, and sociocultural history has come with audible recordings of the human voice for us to decipher. By listening to these recorded voices in all their sonic historicity, we can begin to understand the meaning of human expression as an auditory phenomenon, which is to say, as a relational human phenomenon. What methods of listening, what audile techniques, to use a phrase from Jonathan Stern's book, The Audible Past, have we developed to help us decipher this remarkable audible archive? That's a big and important question that I'm going to save for a future Spoken Web podcast. In the meanwhile, why not hop onto LibriVox or Audible and have a listen to the complete works of Charles Dickens?
A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. Book 1, Recalled to Life. Book 1, Chapter 1, The Period. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope.
Spoken Web is a monthly podcast produced by the Spoken Web team as part of distributing the audio collected from and created using Canadian literary archival recordings found at universities across Canada. Our producers this month are Cheryl Gladue and Jason Camelot. Our podcast project manager is Stacey Copeland. A special thank you to Lisa Gittleman, Patrick Feaster, David Subert, John Miller, and Matthew Rubery for their candid interviews and continued contributions to Spoken Web. An extra special thank you to everyone who joined us for last month's hashtag Spoken Web Pod listening party in celebration of our inaugural episode. Add your voice to the mix on Twitter with hashtag Spoken Web Pod. To find out more about Spoken Web, visit spokenweb.ca and subscribe to the Spoken Web podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. If you love us, let us know. Please rate and leave a comment on iTunes or say hi on our social media at Spoken Web Canada. We'll see you back here next month for another episode of the Spoken Web podcast, stories about how literature sounds.